again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 186. This is the podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. And a special thanks to our lead sponsor for 2015, the California Cut Flower Commission, committed to making a difference as an advocate for American-grown flowers. Learn more at ccfc.org. In the past year, in addition to this podcast's primary focus on American flowers, farmers, and designers, I've interviewed a handful of Slow Flowers-minded farmers and designers based in the UK and Australia. There are obvious parallels between these folks and what we're experiencing in a renaissance and return to domestic flowers here in the U.S. Sadly, as we've experienced in our own native land, the floral industry in many other nations has been outsourced and hurt by competition from countries with low labor costs and less stringent environmental practices. So I'm inspired by the creativity and kindred spirit of all flower farmers who want to rekindle interest and demand for homegrown flowers, and the mindful florists who want to differentiate themselves in the marketplace by sourcing local, seasonal, and domestic flowers. Today's guest is a perfect voice to invite into this conversation. Meet Georgie Newberry, a British farmer florist who owns Common Farm Flowers with her husband, Fabrizio Bocca. This husband and wife team grow British cut flowers on a beautiful plot between Bruton and Wincanton in Somerset, a few hours west of London. The occasion for our interview is the February 15th U.S. publication of Georgie's brand new book, The Flower Farmer's Year: How to Grow Cut Flowers for Pleasure and Profit, published by Green Books UK and available online at Powell's Books and Amazon, among other places here in the U.S. Visit DeborahPrinzing.com to see photos from the book, as well as to see photos of Common Farm Flowers and Georgie's floral designs, and to follow links to her many social sites. Common Farm Flowers is an artisan florist company, which means Georgie and Fabrizio grow nearly everything used in their floristry, expressing floral design as, quote, a craft in which artistic flair is combined with imaginative use of the material at hand to make arrangements which are full of life and air, which dance. That's quite lovely. Launched in 2010, Common Farm Flowers has taken off in 5 years despite its rural locale. As they write on the website, there's clearly a market for British-grown eco-cut flowers, and we're delighted by the reception we've had for the flowers we grow here and the floristry we do. Common Farm Flowers sends British flower bouquets by post 12 months a year. It supplies and arranges lush wedding flowers throughout Somerset, the Southwest, in London, and beyond, and runs workshops on subjects ranging from flower farming for beginners to do-your-own wedding flowers. The farm has taken its flowers to RHS Chelsea, RHS Chelsea in Bloom, and has been featured in British Country Living, The English Garden, The Telegraph, and more. Georgie frequently gives talks to horticulture societies and gardening clubs on growing cut flowers for the home, planting a cut flower border, and seminars on dahlia and sweet pea cultivation. The Flower Farmer's Year covers how to grow your own cut flowers to fill your home with the gorgeous colors and heavenly scents of your favorite blooms, knowing that they haven't traveled thousands of miles. Georgie combines boundless passion with down-to-earth guidance and practical advice, drawing on her own experience as an artisan flower farmer and florist as she takes readers through several topics, including how to start a cut flower patch, what to grow, and that means annuals, biennials, perennials, bulbs and corms, shrubs, roses, dahlias, sweet peas, herbs, and wildflowers, cutting, conditioning, and presenting cut flowers, starting a cut flower business, where to sell your flowers, marketing and social media for flower farmers, and that annual planner, the Flower Farmer's Year. So whether you want to grow for your own pleasure or start your own business, this is the perfect guide to add to your library. And I'm delighted to welcome Georgie to the Slow Flowers Podcast today. Welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing. And I am so delighted to have a very special guest on the line all the way from the UK, Georgie Newbery, flower farmer and author. Hi, Georgie.
Hi, Deborah.
It's great to hear from you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. So Georgie is has a storied past, all good and all beauty. And she and her husband, Fabrizio Bocca, are the owners of Common Farm Flowers, which is in the Somerset district of the UK. We're going to talk about Georgie's brand new book, which is just out and available in the US, The Flower Farmer's Year. But first, I thought I'd just ask you to tell us your story, Georgie. You have a creative background that caught my eye when I read about it in the New York Times. Can I just read a little section of what they wrote about you?
Of course.
Just to embarrass you. Well, they call you a fashionista, and the piece I read online said, during her glamorous previous life in the 1990s, Newbery was the assistant to Susan Train, the legendary Paris bureau chief of American Vogue, and later served as office manager for John Galliano back when he was being courted to take over Givenchy. Next, she moved to London, where she penned three rollicking romans à clef about the fashion industry before leaving that world for good. Newbery is a self-taught flower arranger who developed her eye from two excellent sources, the Vogue offices in Paris, where gorgeous bouquets were regularly ordered as well as received, and from her mother, Jilly Newbery, who worked as the florist for the Dorchester Hotel in London in the 1960s. And you were quoted as saying that your mother did the flowers for the Queen Mum to send to the funeral of Winston Churchill, a wreath of red roses, which she delivered herself at the Blenheim gravesite in her Sunbeam Alpine. That must have been her vehicle, right?
Yes. She had a little sports car.
Oh, that's great. Well, that is, I truly believe that fashion influences flowers, because my background's in textile design, so I totally get where you're coming from. But how exciting. This is this makes you kind of a triple threat. You can write, you can grow, and you can design, and you probably can sew too, right?
I'm not so brilliant at sewing, although as a child I was very keen. I used to make all my dolls' clothes, and I used to have a doll's house that was always full of things I made for it. So I think I've always had a thing about making things in miniature. And I think floristry is just making miniature gardens, like when I was a little girl and I used to make miniature gardens.
That's a beautiful description. Well, so Georgie, tell me about Common Farm Flowers. How did you end up starting this business? You write about this in the book, that it was sort of a modest beginnings that kind of took off and blew up, right?
Yeah, we had no idea. I think as you say, my background is in writing. Having done my stint as a fashionista in Paris, I then wrote novels. And by the time I moved down here to marry my husband, I was developing television programs in London. And we bought this kind of really falling down farmhouse, and which came with 7 acres. And we had an idea that we would be market gardeners of some kind, but we never thought that would be our full-time career. I assumed I would carry on writing. And he, at the time, was an antiques dealer and artist.
And this was this around 2010, or that's when you started the business, but you moved to Somerset?
Business. Yeah, no, this was around 2004 we bought the house. Okay. And we then very quickly had two small children. And we battled away doing up the house, and I was still writing, and he was still selling antiques, and we sort of struggled on until I woke up one day when my little girl was about 6 months old, and I thought, I can't do this writing. I can't
right.
Make my brain. I didn't see how I could find the time.
I remember working at a business newspaper with a newborn and trying to nurse him with one arm while writing a column with my right hand at the keyboard. Like, what do women do? It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. And I really needed cash flow. And you know how when you're writing, you get big projects and then you work up them for 3 or 4 months and then you get a big check and then you work at something else for a long time and you have to spend time, you know, going to London to get the projects and secure the work. And I just couldn't afford it. I wasn't making enough money. And it seemed to me that we were already selling sweet peas at the front gate, kind of in a very small way. And then a neighbor sent me a bunch of flowers through the post. And because I'm not a very nice person, I looked up to see how much they cost. And I was
it like from a, like a traditional wire service, that kind of thing?
Yeah. 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 Well, no, from, it was a very good quality. Somebody who's now one of my competitors, of course. Mm. And I was really impressed. I thought, my goodness, that's plenty of money. Look at that. Mm. You could do that. Mm. So I found some boxes online and I made up some bouquets out of the garden I had then, which was a, you know, an ordinary sized domestic garden, and tried sending them through the post, and they arrived in fairly good condition and they were fine and people said they were lovely and they lasted. And I was inspired because I felt that this was something I could do while I was breastfeeding and wiping people's bottoms and, you know, when
a
you
mom
have,
job.
Well, you know, when you have very small children, you can only achieve things in sort of 20-minute increments between all the other jobs that need doing. And I felt so. I kind of decided, you know, the one thing that didn't get dropped despite all the crises that having small children force upon you, I found that I was still gardening. It was the thing that I was still doing. I was still sowing seeds. And I figured that if that was the one thing I still did, no matter how little time I had, then that would be the thing to make a business out of.
That's because, really cool. Yeah, well, kept your sanity.
It was keeping my sanity anyway. And now I teach all kinds of different workshops. And when people say to me, oh, I want to start a kitchen table business, I always say, what is the thing that you do? Whatever, you know, it doesn't matter how busy or stressed or tired or, and what is the one thing that you do? And that's the thing to make into a business, because you'll do it. You like it enough.
Well, it's interesting because I spent a lot of time before we got on the line together looking through how you created the Flower Farmer's Year, how you organized the book, what kind of information you give. And you're very forthcoming with advice on it. You know, first of all, do this for fun if you love it. But if you want it to be a business, you know, I'm going to give you the down and dirty, the pros and the cons, yeah, because it's not a little fantasy that many people expect when they read about you and other farmers and florists
really
in magazines.
Hard work. Yeah, it's really, I mean, I seriously do still, nearly 5 years since we started, and I still work probably, I maybe don't do a 70-hour week anymore, but I certainly do a 60-hour week, no question about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a job for wimps.
Well, no. And so you have this production side of the business, and you, it sounds like you started shipping or selling mainly by post. Is that because Somerset is a little remote? How far are you from London?
We're a couple of hours from London. Somerset's a little remote. And also, I knew that it's quite sparsely populated where we live. You know, if I had a shop in the local town, I might get a footfall in the hundreds during the day. Most of whom would not necessarily every day be wanting to buy flowers. It would be the same footfall day after day after day. And they'd maybe buy flowers for Christmas or Valentine's or Mothering Sunday, but they wouldn't be a big enough market for every day for me to be running a business every day. So I figured if I went UK wide, then I would find a much bigger market. And
right,
thanks to Twitter and the internet, small businesses like mine in rural, sparsely populated areas can find their market online. And that I work very, very hard on my social media, but it has repaid me in spades.
Well, we're jumping all over the place, but I want to just follow up on that statement in that, and I know our listeners can follow us because this is how all of my interviews are. But you mentioned, you wrote in the book that a public relations firm quoted you £10,000 for a 1-year contract or something,
yes,
like that?
For a retainer fee.
Oh my goodness. That must have sounded like, you know, your child's college education or something. I mean, that
it
just...
was just crazy. There was no way, no way I could do that. But I had, in the fortnight since those people came to see me and between their coming to see us and their making an offer to look after our PR interests for a measly £10,000 a year, I had picked up a couple of hundred followers on Twitter. And I realized that if I really focused on my social media and took it seriously and made it part of my job, then I could do my own my own PR.
Mm-hmm. What was that in 2010 or I can't even remember when Twitter started, 2012 or something. It's more recent than when you.
No. It must have been about 2011, maybe.
Okay.
And it just took off. It was amazing. And
how do people find you? Are you Common Farm Flowers on Twitter or what are your addresses?
Well, annoyingly on Twitter, I'm at The Flower Farmer because in those days I didn't realize you really need to be the same thing everywhere.
Oh, and that makes me feel so good to hear.
And it's too late to change.
Exactly.
So on Twitter, I'm at The Flower Farmer, but on Instagram, I'm Common Farm Flowers. On Facebook, I'm Common Farm Flowers. Where else? Pinterest, I'm Common Farm Flowers.
Okay.
The website
is Common. Yeah. And I'll put all those links on my show notes at deborahprinzing.com so people can just click through and follow you on all those places.
That's really kind. Thank you.
I have a burning question, though, and I guess this is an American's ignorance. Is the UK of a size that you can pretty much ship your fresh-cut flowers overnight to any address in the entire Commonwealth?
More or less. Okay. I can ship overnight UK mainland. I can't get to all the outer islands overnight.
Sure.
But, yeah, UK mainland, I can ship overnight. And they arrive fresh. So they're usually cut in the morning here, and they are on the kitchen table of the person who's receiving them the following afternoon.
That's
amazingly
wonderful.
Fast. Yeah.
And do you have any special, I don't know, ice packs or bagging techniques?
We keep it incredibly simple. And I know that tonight on British Flowers Hour, as we speak, I think, it's British Flowers Hour on Twitter, and they're talking about shipping and couriers and how people do it. And we keep it really simple. We use aqua packs with clean water, no chemicals, no, okay. We don't add, you know, there are the kind of nappy bag material things you can do.
So, Georgie, I guess because your climate is relatively benign, you're able to harvest flowers and ship them almost 12 months of the year, right?
We are. I will admit that we more or less close our garden from kind of mid-November till about now. Because we're in a frost pocket and there's a limit to how much I can fight that. But our Cornish neighbours in the West Country, so not very far from here, supply us all the way through the winter because they don't freeze. And the quality of the flowers we get in from our Cornish colleagues are so fantastic. So they work really, really hard on our behalf all the way through the winter months. And then we're just beginning to start to cut the garden now. And it's a very exciting time of year. It's sort of, we all skip about. We go, oh, there's an anemone. The anemones are out. Look.
Oh, I know. Isn't that, it's like you've forgotten what they looked like after three other seasons have passed.
Well, it's amazing how exciting every year it is.
Yeah.
When the farm.
How many different varieties are you growing then at the farm?
Well, the awful truth is I sat down once to count and I figure we grow in the region of 250 different varieties of cut flowers and foliage.
Wow.
Which has stupid, but.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. You're not taking your own advice and narrowing your market, but who would, right?
The sensible person, I think a sensible flower farmer would grow maybe 15 different varieties of cut flowers and they could buy in from their colleagues locally to supply other things if they want to do floristry. You know, that would be the sensible way to do it. But I think my inner gardener, no matter how much I lecture other people on the sensible way to do things, do what I say, not what I do.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you have this expertise now because you share how to grow annuals, biennials, perennials, bulbs and corms, shrubs, roses, dahlias, sweet peas, herbs, wildflowers, hedgerows, all of these categories in the Flower Farmer's Year. I mean, you had to be comprehensive for just documenting, you know, the options for people, right?
Yes. And also, I think that if one is running a business like this, in which one inevitably works really, really long hours, then I think it's really important that people look at what is it in that keeps it interesting for them. You know, you've got to keep excited by your project. And
right.
I think,
you don't want to be a monocrop where you're just doing one type of flower 12 months of the year. You'd be bored.
I would be. Other people might be rich, of course, if they did that. I'm certainly not rich. but I would be, I am very easily distracted. And so I love having lots and lots of little things to skip about. And I love the creativity of the floristry. And if I didn't grow such a wide variety of flowers to crop, I wouldn't have those, you know, those weddings in the summer when the bride's bouquet has 20 different ingredients. I wouldn't be able to do that.
Right. And that's perfect segue for us, because we've only been talking about your growing and direct mail kind of British flowers by post facet of your business. How does that balance out with the, which I love the term floristry, the floral design work that is now also demanding your time? How do you divide your time?
Well, I looked, when we started, I looked at lots of businesses locally. You know, this is a tough area. Rural England is a tough place to make a living. And I looked at the businesses which did well, and there's a particular farm shop down the road from us run by a family called the Kimbers, and they had three strings to their bow, if you like. Uh-huh. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, that's really clever, because it means that when one part of their business is doing well, then it's supporting the other parts that may not be being so busy. But also all three different parts of their business advertise the other parts.
Sure.
And so that's when we thought, okay, well, we'll do flowers by post as our everyday bread and butter. We'll do weddings because they're fun creatively, but also they're good money. You know,
right.
Let's be honest, this is a business. I've got a family of four to keep. And we will do the workshops because I love to share, as you can see by my book. I overshare all the time. I talk.
And the workshops and teaching, it does take you on the road. I mean, people, maybe they do come to you and attend workshops at your farm, but you're also traveling quite a bit, right?
Yes, more. I'm traveling more and more, which I really enjoy because, again, you know, a change of scene is like a mini holiday. And but we also when we bought this place, it has quite a large and it was very derelict barn hanging off the side of it. And last summer we took the plunge and we turned the barn into the place where we run the business, because the business had outgrown the house.
Sure.
So slightly. So we now have this wonderful studio. I'm so lucky. I still don't really believe it's mine. When I walk in the morning, I'm like, no, that's not really my space.
Wow. So then that's where you'll be teaching on-site workshops then?
Yes. So they've done so well. Where it's so nice to be able to teach in a studio space, especially designed for it, rather than in the house where I was always having to hide the laundry and the kids' toys. And it was just... it was really tough teaching in the house. And so it's very, very nice. So we're doing more workshops because they're fun and people seem to like coming here and we love to share what we do. So it's a win-win situation for everybody.
So those are the three strings to your bow. And then you added writing a book. So I guess you have four strings to your bow.
That's called being a glutton for punishment.
Well, you're obviously, once a writer, always a writer. You came out of that profession, but, the blog could have arguably satisfied your urge to write, but which is the blog that's attached to your website, and we'll make sure we share that link with people.
Thank
but had you been chased by publishers or by students, or how did this come about?
Well, I think I love the teaching. I love the workshops. They're really, really good fun. And I felt as though I was learning so much from my students about what people wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And so I felt I had a lot bubbling away in my head. And you know what it's like if you're once a writer, always a writer. You always want to have a book out there. There's something really crazy. It's a stupid thing to want to do, write a book.
Yeah,
because
it is.
It takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and you don't really make any money.
But it's somehow, it's probably a lot like growing flowers. You're just compelled to do it. You can't not do it. Yeah.
And I guess also I have got to the stage, you know, my kids are now 8 and 5. And so I do have a little bit more time. I'm not working in 20-minute increments. I can probably get an hour at a time between activities. And so I have very, very little time on my own. But writing forces me to make time on my own. And
sure.
I love time on my own, and just, I write in bed a lot. So I will get up very early in the morning and, tiptoe downstairs to the spare room and hide myself away and write in bed. And that's my time. And I'll drink a whole pot of tea and get quite a lot done. And I almost feel as though, you know, I get up in the morning then and get the kids breakfast and do the school run and all that stuff. And I feel as though I've done a day's work. I feel as though I've achieved something. So if the rest of the day I spend playing catch up, which is often the case, at least then I've achieved something before everybody else.
Right. Up in the morning. Right. There is something tangible about words on the page. I do agree with that. It's very gratifying.
It is a really odd thing. And I was talking to another friend of mine who's a seed supplier man called Higgledy Garden. And he is often thinking about, shall I write a book? Shall I write a book? And I said, the urge has got to be stronger than your common sense.
It's so true. Well, so how did this come about? Had you been approached by the publisher, or did you just sort of start kind of sketching out what you would share that's, in a way, it embodies what you're teaching in your flower farming for beginners class, right?
Well, yes, it is. The truth is, okay, you want the real truth. I had to write a business plan for the bank, and I find writing business plans really, really hard because I find it very difficult to bring into like a page long declaration what I'm trying to achieve here. So instead of writing the business plan, I wrote a book proposal and it took about the same amount. It took that afternoon.
Brilliant.
And I sent it off to various editors, and Green Books came back and made an offer, and I said, that's not enough. And they said, okay, well, have a bit more. And there we were, suddenly writing the book.
Wonderful. So you spent about a year working on it, or was it faster than that?
It was about a year. Mostly between 5 and 7 in the morning.
I did my first book when my children were about 4 and 9. So kind of the same place. And I used to say I work from 9 to noon and 9 to midnight. And that was like the only time I could possibly not have to do childcare. So I feel for you. I'm really impressed. You just, you know what, the person who wrote the foreword to your book, said you have been called a cross between an enchantress and a Wonder Woman. Now I get that. The enchantress is the magic that you create, and the Wonder Woman is just what you're achieving in a 24-hour period, right?
I think I'm not sure why I'm so driven, but I think there are a lot of very driven people out there, and I'm just one of them. Maybe it's an illness or a compulsion or something.
Well, you know, it sounds like you really came from a mother who was a professional when a lot of other young women your age may not have had mothers who worked. Absolutely. And that was probably part of it.
Yeah, my mom always worked, and my father also was an entrepreneur. So it was normal in my family. It was very normal that you started a business and you worked for yourself. And also that in my family, it's normal to assume that it'll all be all right and that you can.
How hard can it be, right?
Yeah, how hard can it be? And to, starting in the UK at the moment, to start a cut flower growing business when a lot of the established cut flower growing businesses in the UK have given up. The old business models just don't work. And so for someone like me to go, oh, okay, well, never mind, I'm just going to do that, would seem crazy. So, I'm not a businesswoman, you know, I don't have a background in spreadsheets and business management and all that stuff. But I have to say, I have learned a lot on the hoof.
Yes, exactly.
And it's been really, really interesting. You know, I have discovered another interest, if you like, in my life is how to run businesses, but not just run any old business, run a business which ostensibly can't work. How can you make something like this profitable?
Well, I know. And there's a term that is somewhat considered derogatory in the US at least, which is called a lifestyle business, which is sort of slightly less offensive than calling it a hobby. But, you know, there's that idea that, oh, you're a winemaker. Sure, you're making no money, but you make wine in your garage or whatever. And you can call it a business. But I do believe that there is a place for living a creative lifestyle and supporting yourself doing it. And you are going down that path, I think.
Well, exactly. And while we are keeping a family of four on this. So while people can, you're quite right. people do go, oh yes, it's a lifestyle business. And you go, yeah, well, it's quite a lifestyle.
Yeah, 70 hours a week lifestyle.
It's a 70 hours a week lifestyle. But also I'm having a really, while it's very, very stressful, and in the winter months when we don't do so much business, I kind of lie in bed with anxiety key turning in my heart all night, I'm having a really good time. You know, I'm going, like, I'm giving a talk tomorrow night at the Garden Museum. I'm then at the Country Living Fair. I'm taking the Common Farm Flowers story out to all sorts of festivals this summer. We're at the Chelsea Flower Show, and we get to
That's
do
great.
These creative weddings. And, you know, I have this beginning to be very interesting garden for the plants people out there. It's beginning to be really quite an interesting plant collection, which is, you know, the secret thing that gardeners can't resist.
Right. It's almost, yes. And that helps because, as you said, you're in a rural location, but if you can become a destination education garden and learning center, then that there's something beautiful for people to see when they come take a workshop.
Yeah, and that's another income stream. I mean, you know, I belong to a group on Facebook called the Regrarians, and I don't often contribute, but I often read posts. And there was a lady saying that she runs a small holding in Texas, and they grow an enormous amount of vegetables. And she said, I'm beginning to realize the lie. I can't make a living. We cannot live on our little farm just growing vegetables. And I thought, you know, she bakes and does something else mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, actually, small farms historically have never just lived on the small farm. They've always had bed and breakfasts or pop-up restaurants or run another little business on the side. Small enterprises like this have always had three or four strings to their bow to keep mm-hmm. going. And I think historically that's meant that that's how family businesses have worked for thousands of years.
That's a really good analogy.
Yeah.
Sure. I know you don't have a ton of time left, and could talk all day, but I wanted to ask you just about the sort of what's in the climate right now in the British floral world. And you write on your website, there's clearly a market for British-grown eco-cut flowers, and we're delighted by the reception we've had for the flowers we grow here. But then, you know, you also talk about in your book that nobody buys from anybody just because your flowers are local or organic. They buy from you because you're good at what you do. Yeah. Being local and organic is the sugar on an already beautifully produced floral cake. So how do you reconcile sort of that truth plus the existence of this demand that seems to be growing?
There are a lot of small growers in the UK, and a lot of them come here to do my flower farming for beginners course. And they often come with real stars in their eyes, you know, and I say to them, who amongst you can see yourselves standing in your beautiful garden with acres of flowers, having a really wonderful time with, you know, with perhaps a radio and a robin tweeting on your fork handle, you know, and they have this kind of lovely picture. And nearly all of them stick their hands in there and go, yeah, yeah, that's what I think. And I think my point is that while the British public is definitely in the market for locally grown flowers, the British public is also in the market for something that's very beautifully produced. I think we need to value what we produce and charge accordingly. We're not in a race to the bottom here.
Right. You don't want to compete on price with imports or anything like that.
You can't compete. You simply can't. We don't have the numbers. And, you know, the law in this country means that you have to pay your staff a living wage, which is fantastic. And if you have, the minute you have anybody helping you, your costs go through the roof. And so therefore that is inevitably to an extent reflected in your prices. And that, I think, is a good thing. But having said that, therefore, your product has to be worth that price. It has to be high-end, beautifully produced, really beautifully presented, because the customer won't come back a second time if the product isn't up to scratch. If you sell kind of supermarket product at supermarket prices, you won't be able to make a living. So you need to do something higher-end, which is better quality, more beautifully presented, and touch wood, when we do this, we sell out, which is great because people seem to really like, they really, really like it. But I know I am under no illusion that if I produced something that was just, that was sold on the back of the fact that it was locally grown, I wouldn't make necessarily make a living. It's the it's the quality that has to be second to none.
Yeah, you're recognizing that you can sell local and organic flowers, but only if you're selling a couture product, a value-added product.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think that's very similar to what flower farmers and florists in the U.S. are seeing, that they don't want to be in a situation where they're competing on price. They want to compete on the uniqueness and the rarity and the uncommon quality that sparks people's imagination and has a romance to it and, you know, is exceptional. And so
I totally agree. If I were to just grow ordinary, 100,000 ordinary tulips, I could not sell them. I couldn't make the money. But the other growers, the big importers can't import the very, very delicate little, the fluffy umbellifers and the wildflowers that we grow. I think it's a different product. What we have is a completely different product and we're working for a completely different market. And I think as we remember that as creators and as growers, then we'll be fine. It's when we forget that and we try and join the race to the bottom that we'll be in trouble and won't make a living.
But you do. It sounds like over the course of 5 years in business with Common Farm Flowers that you've seen an increase, a steady increase in customers wanting to purchase your flowers and more weddings being booked and more lectures being booked. So there's something going on. There's some momentum that your timing was perfect with.
Yes. I didn't know, but yes, I'm very grateful. I clearly got in at the right time.
Well, and I don't think it's just timing. I think it's talent. So pat yourself on the back for that. Before we go, you alluded to the Chelsea Flower Show. So it sounds like you're not able to say exactly whose garden you're going to be involved in, but that you will have some presence there. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I can't really say yet, but I will be saying, I'm sure it'll be soon. I mean, Chelsea's only, it's 18th of May is press day. So, it's really only not, it's just 2 months away. So, things are getting closer and closer. And, I'm working with a friend I met on Twitter, in fact, several years ago. And I've worked with her before and, we get on very well and share, I think, a vision of, we work in very, very similar ways. She's a gardener and I'm the florist, but I think what we see at the end of the day is very similar. So it's great fun to work with her. And we'll,
sounds like a wonderful collaboration creatively.
I hope so. And then there's a third member of the team who is joining in too. So yeah, watch this space on the blog. There'll be a great deal about it on the blog when the time comes.
Well, and I'm coming to Chelsea and I have applied for my press credentials. So I may actually come find you on press day.
Well,
and
yeah,
wouldn't that be awesome?
I applied for my press pass today. Hopefully, I'll be definitely there on the Sunday, but that's because I'm doing the floristry. But hopefully I'll be there on the Monday too.
Oh, that's exciting. So are you going to also have an exhibit, like selling your book somewhere? Or is that...
No, not at Chelsea this year. I have got a sort of secret plan for... maybe 2016, but
but for this year people can buy your book online and certainly it might be less available in some garden shops in Seattle I live in Seattle, but in the U.S. but I know that they can purchase it online, so I'll be sure that I provide that ordering information so people can get it. It's a beautiful book. And your husband did the illustrations, I see.
Yes, he did the illustrations. I did most of the photographs. He's a very talented artist and he does those very good sort of slightly cartoony illustrations really well.
Oh no, they're fantastic. And they're you have to show some technical aspects of, you know, how to build a raised bed and how to create a propagation table. These are really excellent, bits of essential information that people will take home and follow. So kudos to you both for that.
Yeah, he's there. Well, I'm doing, I'm just about to finish my next book and, he's done some illustrations for that. Actually, he hasn't done them yet, but he will do them.
What's that? Can you say what that's about?
Yes, it's called Grow Your Own Wedding Flowers. And I want to encourage more people to grow their own wedding flowers. So,
and this is also the basis of one of your workshops that you teach, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, Georgie.
It's fun and it's lovely. It's lovely. I love, you know, I want people to have what they long for at their weddings. And I think anybody who has a little bit of gardening experience and a little patch of land, you don't need very much. I'm sure you know, you can get an enormous amount of cut flowers out of a very small patch.
Well, so, and yes, and you know, you really covered that well in, you know, in the sort of early part of the book about, you know, the amount of land required to, I guess you compared it to basically three allotment patches.
Yeah.
That you could really churn out a plenty of flowers for yourself and to sell to others.
Absolutely. Our first year, I'd say we had less than the size of three allotments when we first started. Our first year, I'd say we used one allotment. The size of one allotment. And we did five weddings, lots of farmers markets, flowers by post. I mean, it wasn't a huge business, but we were slightly kind of seeing how it would go.
Sure.
And it really did very well for us. And I think if people want to get into this business, A, there is definitely a market for it, but B, for goodness sake, start small, because then you won't frighten yourself.
Then you won't start with 200 plus flower varieties. Like Georgie Newberry, the crazy woman over there in the UK who we all, I mean, it's a beautiful life. And I know you work harder than if you were sitting at Vogue magazine, right? So
yeah.
Kudos to you. And I'm so glad we finally connected. We had some technical difficulties, but we ended up with a lovely conversation that will be fun for people to follow along with, and then to find you and find you on all your social platforms, because there's so much that we can learn from what you're doing. And I think there's some good cross-pollination between what the U.S. American grown movement is happening here with Slow Flowers, and then what's happening with the UK British grown flowers movement. So we're kind of on a parallel track.
I think so. I love looking at how all the Americans, and actually I'm beginning to find some Australian growers too.
Yes.
And
yes.
I feel as though we're all around the world. There are people just growing in their own backyards for their local market, and the more we do it, the happier the bees will be, and our neighbors will be happy, and the flowers will be scented. And I don't think for a second that the big Venezuelan growers are going to lose out in any way at all. Their market is absolutely safe. But meanwhile, we are all creating something beautiful in our own backyards. And I think if we're doing it from Adelaide to Adelstrop via Arkansas, then that's fantastic.
Georgie, thank you so much. I really enjoyed meeting you, and I know we'll get to meet in person, but I'm delighted to be able to share this with the listeners of the podcast. And we'll also maybe include some photos from the book so people can get a little sneak preview of the flowers you're growing and your design work as well.
Oh, thank you, Deborah. And hopefully we'll meet at Chelsea. It'd be really fun to meet up.
Okay, well, have a good week. You've got a full plate, so I'm going to let you go.
Thank you very much. See you soon.
Thanks, Georgie.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining me this week, and please return again as I continue to share insightful and educational episodes recorded exclusively for the Slow Flowers podcast. I've been in San Francisco this past week to speak at the San Francisco Flower and Garden Show, to attend the Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers meeting in San Jose, and to scout gardens and flower farms in Santa Cruz for future stories. In the coming weeks, you'll hear from some of the people I've met on this trip, and I know you'll find their stories a source of inspiration for your own endeavors. Thanks to listeners, this podcast has been downloaded more than 40,000 times. If you like what you hear, please consider logging on to iTunes and posting a listener review. Until next week, please join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. The contents and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or any other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew Wheatley and Hannah Holtgertz. Learn more about their work at shellandtree.com.